This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, hate crimes, proactive investigations, and island time of death. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode 67 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. And this week, I'm answering your questions about what constitutes a hate crime, how to use search warrants in a proactive investigation where a crime hasn't occurred yet, and death investigations in paradise. But before we get into that, as always, I need to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from deborahdunbar.com, CC Jameson from ccjameson.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of vickytharp.com, Chris Ann, Larry Darter, and Natalie Borelli of natalieborelli.com for their support. Also, special thanks to Craig Kingsman of craigkingsman.com for upping his monthly Patreon pledge to the Gold Shield level. Thank you so much. I also want to send a huge thank you to my Coffee Club patrons for your support. You all keep the lights on in the Bureau, and I truly appreciate every single one of you. You can find links to all of the listeners supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/67. And to learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon, Patreon. And our first question this week comes from author Jesse Nori. Jesse writes, "Hi, what makes a crime a hate crime? What evidence would be needed to prosecute a crime as a hate crime? And do the accused ever point the finger back at prosecutors, saying, quote, I'm only being prosecuted because I'm part of a marginalized group, and therefore prosecuting me is a hate crime? Or some such thing. Hopefully you get the point. Thanks." Great question, Jesse. Crimes become hate crimes when the motive for the crime, the specific intention of the suspect, was to commit the crime against their victim because of the victim's perceived disability, gender, nationality, race or ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or the victim's association with a person or group with one or more of these actual or perceived characteristics. So if I commit any crime, a battery, a robbery, a rape, a murder, because of my perception of your gender or sexual orientation or race or what have you, then that's a hate crime. Even if that list doesn't actually apply to you, but let's say I, as the suspect, think it applies to you, that still makes it a hate crime. Does that make sense? So if I hit someone because I think they're gay, then that's a hate crime, regardless of whether or not my victim is actually gay or not. The key thing to understand is that hate crimes are really just regular crimes, like robbery, battery, rape, murder, like I just mentioned, but they are committed with an intent of hatred against a perceived characteristic. What makes this hate crime designation different is that it is a sentence enhancement, meaning stiffer penalties for the crime than if it was just a regular crime not motivated by hate. Now, for your detective, it means they need to not only prove who committed the crime, but they also have to prove that their intention was based on targeting this victim because of one or more of those characteristics listed in the criminal statute. So that may hinge on the interrogation of the suspect, or it could be proven by witness statements about what the suspect, let's say, was yelling or was wearing at the time of the crime. Can I prove a stabbing is a hate crime because a light-skinned male stabs a dark-skinned male? Just given those facts, no, I can't. But if I have witness statements or cell phone video or surveillance video of the suspect yelling racial slurs at the time of the attack or wearing neo-Nazi tattoos or clothing while attacking a victim that is perceived to have a characteristic like dark skin or sexual orientation that neo-Nazis are known to target, that's a pretty easy hate crime to prove. Pretty much any crime can be a hate crime if you can show the relation between the crime and the victim or victims being targeted. Is a swastika painted on your own front door a crime? Probably not, thanks to the First Amendment's right to free speech. unless you have a landlord. And I know some of my EU listeners are probably thinking, what the right now? But painting that same swastika on a synagogue or a church or a gay bar is definitely a hate crime because it's vandalism, the crime, targeting the person or persons associated with that location. So the evidence needed to prove the hate crime really comes down to whatever is required to get a jury to believe that the suspect targeted the victim or victims based upon their perceived disability, gender, nationality, race or ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation, or that the victim's association with a person or group associated with that list. And to answer your last question, Jesse, do the accused ever point the finger back at prosecutors saying I'm only being prosecuted because I'm part of a marginalized group and therefore prosecuting me is a hate crime? First of all, it's not a hate crime because being prosecuted isn't a crime. But I'm pretty sure that's happened. And without getting into politics, I think it's happening even more today. But it is a weak, very weak defense because the suspect is essentially admitting to committing the crime. Offering a justification or a rationalization, let's call it what it is, it's an excuse, is saying, yeah, I did this, but I did it because, insert the blank. And that, my friends, is what we call an admission of guilt. Thanks for the question, Jesse. Gold Shield patron Deborah Dunbar joined me for one of my Gold Shield patron-only live streams and asked a great question that prompted an explanation I wanted to share here on the podcast. And first of all, if you weren't aware, one of the benefits of being a Gold Shield patron is getting access to live streams with me and our small group of Gold Shield patrons to be able to get immediate answers to your question. And thanks to Deborah from DeborahDunbar.com, as you heard just a few minutes ago, for giving me the thumbs up to use this on the podcast. Now, we talk a lot on this podcast about search warrants, mainly because it's the bread and butter of police work as a detective. But what happens when the crime you're investigating hasn't technically happened yet? Most of the crimes we talk about, and certainly write about in mysteries in particular, are crimes that have already occurred, and we're trying to piece together what happened in the form of a criminal investigation, piecing together what happened in the past. But in my conversation with Deborah, we talked about drugs being shipped to a drug buyer, and how the police would handle that investigation. So in this case, the police become alerted to the fact that this parcel contains drugs, and mailing drugs is a federal crime, but the purchaser of those drugs hasn't received them yet. So how do we handle this investigation? The answer is twofold. First is what we call a controlled delivery. For officer safety reasons, I'm not going to go into the specific tactics of this, but let's just say that when the package is delivered, it's being done under the supervision of law enforcement. But once the bad guy takes possession of that parcel, how does law enforcement proceed? Now, given what you may have learned about search warrants from previous episodes, you might correctly guess that we could legally freeze the scene, meaning we could make entry into the house where the drug parcel is now located, we could detain anyone inside, do a sweep of the house to make sure no one's hiding, and then have one of the cops working on this case write a search warrant while the other cops and the bad guys inside just sit there and wait. Or the detective overseeing this investigation writes what's called an anticipatory search warrant. Normally, a search warrant becomes valid the moment the judge signs the warrant, and then it's valid for 10 days. But that only happens when a crime has already occurred. In a case like this one, we write an affidavit in support of a search warrant that lays out for the judge the probable cause to believe a crime is about to be committed, and that there will be probable cause to search this location for the evidence. So since we are anticipating that this crime will be committed, this search warrant, once signed by the judge, is not valid until the actions set forth in the affidavit and the warrant actually occur. In other words, the search warrant only becomes valid upon the crime being committed. So I write an affidavit that says the Postal Service alerted me to a parcel that contains illegal drugs and is addressed to Bad Guy at 123 Drug House Street. Upon successful delivery to the occupant of 123 Drughouse Street, I request this search warrant be issued for the search and seizure of the illegal drugs inside the premises at 123 Drughouse Street. And all the other language for persons and places and things that to be searched that usually goes into a warrant, I would include as well. Then the judge signs the warrant that the affidavit is justifying, and then we have to wait and see what happens with the parcel delivery. So let's say we try to deliver the drug parcel doing this controlled delivery process, and the homeowner answers the door and says, there's no one named Bad Guy at this address, and he refuses the package. Then our search warrant is not valid, and we go away because the crime of that drug possession has not occurred. However, if the homeowner at 123 Drughouse Street does accept delivery of the drug parcel as expected, then the anticipatory search warrant becomes valid and we are able to serve that warrant immediately. But I personally tend to give Bad Guy, well, I don't know, about 5 minutes before serving the warrant because, I don't know, I just want him to have time to rip open the package. Because if it ends up in front of a jury, it's hard to claim that the drugs weren't yours after you opened up the box and put the dope in your safe or in your pipe or up your nose. So that, my friends, is the anticipatory search warrant. Write the warrant beforehand to save yourself some time and effort after the crime occurs. And this week's last question comes from Coffee Club patron Jean Desrochers of jeandesrochers.com, whom you can also find on Instagram at author Jean Desrochers. And Jean writes, time of death. How is it determined? And do small island jurisdictions do things like this? Or do they need to ship the body out for autopsy and other lab tests, generally speaking? My setting is an island with a population of 50,000. That's 100 miles from an island with 3 million. Do you think I should fudge this just to move along? Actually have used the delays to good effect in my early draft, so I'm happy with that. Also, when would the body be released to the family? And if they were a rich, powerful family, would the police move faster on the lab work and evidence gathering? Thanks, Adam. Thanks for the question, Gene. A lot of this will have to do with the country your island is set in. And I'm picturing an island in the Caribbean or West Indies for this. And having been to the island of Grenada recently, which almost fits this bill, albeit with a population of 100,000 instead of 50, I think it's really up to you on how you want it to play out. For Grenada, the country in the West Indies, is home to St. George's University Medical School. And if you're old enough, you might remember U.S. Marines being deployed to Grenada to rescue American students attending St. George's after a Marxist military coup overturned the existing democratic government. And by the way, I'm going to go off on a bit of a side tangent here. Grenada is an absolute gem that is completely overlooked by Americans. I'm almost reluctant to say this because I don't want to give away the secret, but Grenada is absolutely beautiful, and I love the Grenadian people. During my visit, I cannot count the number of Grenadians that genuinely appreciated and recounted what America did for preserving their democracy. Many of them shook my hand when they learned I was an American, which, if you do any bit of international travel these days, you'll know is very rare. But there are even murals in small towns thanking the U.S. military for what they did. So seriously consider checking out Grenada if you're looking for a nice tropical island vacation. And stay in one of the family-owned resorts. It's not all corporate yet. So if you do, I guarantee you're going to fall in love with the country. You're going to feel safe pretty much everywhere on the island, and you're going to meet amazing people like Mrs. Nora Hollis, who at over 100 years old still runs her corner store every day and is sharp as a tack and as funny as can be. Just amazing memories there. So anyway, if your story, Gene, is set on an island like Grenada, then they'd have no problem using traditional methods of establishing time of death, like measuring liver temperature or examining stomach contents, that kind of thing. But sending those things out to a larger island certainly makes sense if it is a small island that doesn't have those kind of resources. And honestly, more often than not, determining an exact time of death is really more of a ballpark thing, and it rarely, in the real world, plays that huge of a role in an investigation. Just think about your daily life. Even if on vacation in tropical paradise, think about all of the outside things that are better indicators of when someone might have died, other than the biological indicators. Like, when was the last time you opened your Kindle or unlocked your phone or ordered a drink at the bar or rented a stand-up paddleboard or hit the ATM, had your room cleaned or had a waitress check on you at the pool? I realize your story probably isn't someone on vacation, but think about all the things you do during the day that can leave a timestamp trace. Even smartwatches like an Apple Watch or a Fitbit can tell when your heart stops beating. So establishing time of death, or at least narrowing it down to a few hour window, is often pretty easy to do without relying on lab results. As for the autopsy and toxicology results, that is totally up to you on how you want to create it in this story. I'm imagining setting this story on an island is one of the key setups for making these obstacles plausible for you, Gene. So similarly, that rich and powerful family dynamic is up to you as well. Their influence may have more of an effect in a small country, a small island country, than what we would normally see here in the States. So you can definitely play with that as well. I'm all about fudging it, as you said, especially as it can really bog down a story if you aren't careful. If it were me, I would plot out my scenes and decide where I want those results to come in for the most effect as it relates to telling the story, and then kind of reverse engineer the explanations as to why it was either delayed or fast-tracked for it to logically pop up in that scene. So I hope this helps, Gene. And you can find Gene's work at GeneDesrochers.com or on Instagram at author Gene Desrochers. Keyword, password. LastPass. You can support the Bureau by going to my affiliate link, writersdetectivebureau.com/LastPass, to check out LastPass for free or upgrade to LastPass Premium for $3 a month. Hey, how's your NaNoWriMo going so far? If you have a question, send it to me by going to writersdetective.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening. Have a great week and write well.